From Tennessee to Maine, Illinois to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Facebook has been hit with a $5 billion fine for violating the privacy of its users. Jennifer Huddleston of the Mercatus Center is here to talk about how this will impact privacy going forward. Congress has passed a new two-year budget deal, complete with massive increases in federal spending and higher deficits. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Speaking of that budget deal, there was little mention of it during last week's Democratic presidential debates. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the term racist gets thrown around a lot lately, but on his American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom says federal funding to abort Black and Hispanic babies just might fit that category. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The recent $5 billion fine levied against Facebook for improper use of data is just one component of an ongoing debate over the privacy rights of social media users. Here to take a closer look at the issue is Jennifer Huddleston. Jennifer is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Jennifer, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jennifer, we have this fine, $5 billion the Federal Trade Commission has levied against Facebook. Can you tell us what prompted that fine, and what does government hope to accomplish by fining Facebook that amount of money?
This fine, as well as the other elements that were part of the consent decree between Facebook and the Federal Trade Commission, stemmed from a 16-month investigation into potential violations of a prior consent decree that the company had been under regarding certain data privacy practices. So a lot of people may remember last year when Cambridge Analytica was in the headlines. And so this is in a lot of ways the result of an investigation that was prompted by some of the details that were revealed in various concerns about Facebook and privacy about a year and a half ago now. The specifics, though, of this consent decree, though, have to do with violations of the prior consent decree, and particularly the way consumers may have been misled about the use of certain data. So, for example, it mentions the use of phone numbers for two-factor authentication that were then being used for other purposes as well. Similarly, there were some specific elements that were mentioned with regard to notification about use of facial recognition.
As we look at all these things, of course, Americans, consumers, we're all concerned about our data and making sure it is kept confidential and private. This is something, though, that is not limited just to the United States. The European Union has actually taken a number of steps in this area. Very briefly, what have they done?
About a year ago, Europe had a new rule come out that is the General Data Protection Rule, or GDPR. It's a quite extensive compliance regime that all companies operating over there have certain requirements that they have to meet, not just in a kind of a data privacy space, but also with regards to data security and data protection more generally. This costs most companies several million dollars to comply with. And as a result, we actually saw some companies, at least initially, choose to pull out of Europe, in part because of the complexity and cost associated with complying with this. Now, where this relates to the recent FTC Facebook fine is a lot of debate has been, does the U.S. need a similar strict overarching approach to data privacy? And one of the things that this recent action shows is that actually the U.S. approach can have quite a bit of teeth, so to speak. In fact, the $5 billion fine against Facebook is larger than what would have likely been the maximum fine under GDPR, and it's actually the largest data privacy-related fine that the FTC has ever issued.
As we look at the policy that needs to be developed, you recently wrote an article and you outlined four very important areas of questions that need to be asked whenever we develop these policies. So let's take them one by one. The first part, can you define for us exactly what is the problem we're trying to address?
I think that's a good question. And in some ways, that's the large question in the in the room. Of some of this goes to distinguishing between data security, things that concern people with regards to knowing when a data breach has occurred, and data privacy, so your concerns about what information that you may be sharing and making a distinction between those two fields. Also, though, it has a lot to do with, do we want to set one set of preferences for individuals, or do we want to continue to allow individuals to make their own choices when it comes to what information they may or may not share? And is there enough room to allow both those individuals that may be more privacy sensitive to have those options, as well as individuals that may be more willing to give up certain information in exchange for benefits?
As we look at this also, Jennifer, there's a concern that any time the federal government gets involved and they start putting rules and regulations and controls on private industry, that this then inhibits future innovation and new products for consumers. Is there a danger that as we approach trying to bring about more security for data that we could in fact do that?
I think there are two concerns at play there. One is, in prescribing very specific policies, there's a risk that we focus only on the current security and privacy options that we have, rather than in potential innovations that could actually provide more and better options when it comes to both data security and data privacy. Another concern that is related to that question is, what not only does this do for the large players, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Apples of today, but also for the next generation of companies that may be the next great innovative idea or the next trend that really takes off, that now has an extra barrier to entry that they have to overcome, that maybe they can't try certain things that earlier entities were able to try as they were developing their product, particularly given that we want consumers to have a broad range of choices when it comes to finding those pragmatic privacy options that best reflect what they want.
Of course, legislators like to legislate and regulators like to regulate because that's what they do. But if we take a look at the policies that we have currently in place, Jennifer, do they largely address the issue? Do they simply need some tweaking and updating, or does there need to be some comprehensive overhaul here?
There are a couple of different elements there. I think one thing that is important to point out is that there are policies in place, whether it's the FTC's consumer protection standards that we saw in play with the recent Facebook agreement, or if it's certain already existing carve-outs for data that's been considered particularly sensitive, things like COPPA that addresses children's privacy, or things that are specifically targeted at the medical field when it comes to HIPAA or and patient health information, or the financial field when it comes to certain standards that those companies are subjected to. At the same time, a lot of those laws are being a little bit dated now, and so examining even ways that perhaps past laws either need to be updated or could even be potentially preventing more improved data security. Another thing that's really driving this conversation is what's going on at a state level. So we've seen California pass the California Consumer Privacy Act, the CCPA, that is really a quite broad act in terms of the different types of entities it would cover, not only online and offline. So not only have you seen Europe acting and that driving conversation, but you now have states within the United States kind of potentially developing a patchwork system on the question of data privacy that could make it really difficult for particularly online entities.
We have been talking with Jennifer Huddleston, who is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center, that located at George Mason University. Jennifer, tell us just a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go to read your writings on this topic?
The Mercatus Center is an academic research center, and we really look at bridging the gap between academic ideas and public policy on a wide range of issues, from issues affecting technology to things like the minimum wage and healthcare and all sorts of issues. My work focuses on the intersection of law and technology, so data privacy these days is certainly a big part of that. My website can be found on Mercatus's website, which is Mercatus, M-E-R-C-A-T-U-S, jrhudson.org. And then I also tweet about these issues a lot, and I'm on Twitter at jrhuddles.
Jennifer Huddleston of the Mercatus Center. Jennifer, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on the budget deal making its way through Congress. Also, we had Democrat debates this past week. We're going to talk about all of the above. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We have a budget deal. Last week, Scott, we talked about the fact that the nation was about to hit its debt limit. Something had to happen. Something has happened, but a pretty bad deal if you're talking about any sort of fiscal restraint, isn't it?
It is. This is something I think I've talked with you and your listeners about several times since April. We knew that this day was coming when there would be a large budget agreement that would dramatically increase discretionary spending levels for the defense and non-defense categories. So that ended up happening, right? We had the major negotiation between Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So what happens when a Democrat and a Democrat negotiate? All they do is bust through the spending levels and dramatically put our situation, our debt situation, in worse shape than it was before. So this was over $320 billion of spending over the next 2 years that they're going to authorize. And then in addition to that, they're suspending the debt limit through July of 2021. So this is opportunity lost. It is certainly not the art of the deal when it comes to negotiation. There's no spending restraint, no offsets that matter to any degree. It's a situation where we've got some budget gimmicks, but really Pelosi got everything that she asked for, and the only thing that the Trump administration and Secretary Mnuchin were seeking was a 2-year suspension of the debt limit. This ended up passing overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives, with most Democrats voting yes. But you did see more than 2/3 of the House Republicans oppose the legislation and sort of want the spending, I think, in the back of their mind, but they knew that this was a very difficult political vote, so they voted no.
As we drill down in this, Scott, you mentioned it's a 2-year deal. Does that cover the entire budget for the next 2 years, that we're going to basically have this level of spending and there's not any opportunity, perhaps, for Congress, should it actually have the will to do so, which it really never does, to actually maybe dial it back a little bit?
Theoretically, they could, but it's incredibly unlikely that they would ever reopen the budget levels after obtaining this sort of an agreement. What it does is it sets the spending levels that Congress can appropriate toward. There's always the ability for Congress to reopen negotiations and start over. We would encourage them to do that because this is just the drunk sailor with everybody's credit card, including our generation and future generations. So it's very problematic. Nonetheless, I think that this agreement is going to be the law of the land for the next 2 years. And the problem, particularly with this agreement, is that it's the last 2 years of that big budget deal that we agreed to with Barack Obama in 2011. You might remember that being called the Budget Control Act. These are the last 2 fiscal years for that. So when this agreement expires, the appropriators will pretty much just set spending at the current path, and that's why this is really a $2 trillion spending agreement.
We will keep an eye on that going forward. Obviously, the spending pace continues in Washington. Let's switch gears now and talk about the Democratic debates. We had the second round of those debates this past week, and pretty much like the first round, they moved about as far to the left as you could get. How does that really shape up, Scott, in terms of positioning them for a general election?
I don't think that it helps them, and I think that there's some of the moderates that have been on stage that have been warning the radical front runners of these extreme positions and what they will mean in terms of their ability to contrast with President Trump and have a chance to beat him. Obviously, I think that having watched the debates, this very much increases the likelihood that President Trump wins re-election in a landslide, not even a close race. These ideas are so far out there, and really it goes back to the Green New Deal, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez hijacking the policy platform of the political left, and now they're all just racing to abolish private health insurance. They're racing toward open borders, decriminalization of the border. And I think that this is just sort of a gift to President Trump for these very, very far-left positions that at least the front-runners have been taking. Now, Biden has tried to distance himself to a degree, but this is more than Barack Obama 2.0. This is really Joe Biden being dragged over, not toward the center, but to the left. And he's having a hard time holding his own against a large number of other candidates. So I don't think he's particularly performed well. I know that there's some pundits on the left that view him as a front runner, so they want to try to protect that status. But in reality, this is totally an open fight, and we'll be looking forward to more debates beginning in September to see if anybody can increase their position in the polling and have a real shot to take on President Trump other than Joe Biden.
Are we starting yet, Scott, to see this very large Democrat field, 24, 25 candidates? Are they starting to at least sort themselves into a smaller top tier? And at what point are we going to see the bottom 10 or 12 or 15 sort of phase out of this?
Money is an issue, right? If candidates can raise money, they'll be in the debates and they'll have a campaign that can continue to operate. I think what you have seen is a couple of candidates that have been highly searched on Google, and the data analytics are proving that people are interested in what they're saying during the debates. And one of them is sort of this author, Marianne Williamson. She is the most highly Googled candidate out of all the Democrats over the first two debates combined. And then Tulsi Gabbard has also really taken on Kamala Harris and elevated herself in a way. So it'll be interesting to see if that translates to any position change in the polling.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over a 250,000 members from all walks of life, including all 50 states in the union. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, they can look us up on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org, and they can also follow us on Twitter and see all of our quick reaction to the debates at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You might think that budget deal would be a major topic of discussion during the Democratic debates. It was not. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine looks at why.
Just after noon on Thursday, Congress put the finishing touches on a budget-busting, deficit-hiking, $2.7 trillion spending deal that is already on its way to President Donald Trump's desk, where he appears likely to sign it. But you wouldn't know about any of that if your only interaction with politics this week was the Democratic primary debates. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at how both Republicans and Democrats have really abdicated any sort of concern about fiscal policy and exactly why that's a big problem for a country that's facing $22 trillion and growing in national debt. And really, the passage of the budget bill on Thursday throws all of that into stark relief. The budget deal passed with a 67-28 vote in the Senate. There were 23 Republicans and 5 Democrats who voted against the bill, but there was bipartisan support for that new $2.7 trillion spending plan. The same budget deal has already cleared the House. It passed last week by a similarly bipartisan vote of 284-149. All but 16 Democrats voted for the bill in the House, but Republicans were deeply split over it, with 65 Republicans in the House voting for the deal and 132 voting against it. President Donald Trump, it should be noted, has been cheerleading for the spending bill all the way through the process. On Thursday, before the Senate vote, he tweeted that Republicans should, quote, go for it and support the bill, promising that there would always be time to cut spending later. But don't be fooled, the time to cut spending is quickly running out, and this budget deal is pretty bad for the country. It's a two-year, $2.7 trillion deal that hikes federal spending by more than $320 billion annually. Over the next 10 years, it's going to add more than $1.7 trillion to the national debt. Now, the U.S. was already poised to run trillion-dollar deficits for the foreseeable future, but the new budget deal means it's going to be virtually impossible to avoid hitting that threshold in our annual deficit for the next several years. The budget deal also shatters budget caps that Republicans once championed, and it actually hikes spending above the baseline that was in place before the 2011 sequestration, which was a big fight during the Obama years and a big accomplishment, a big curb on spending that Republicans successfully put in place. That is now out the window. And the bill is a massive reversal from where Republicans were on spending issues just a few years ago. In 2016, when Trump was elected and Republicans grabbed control of all aspects of the federal government, the United States was carrying about $19 trillion in debt. Today, in no small part due to the 2018 budget deal that the Republican-controlled Congress passed and Trump signed, the national debt has soared past $22 trillion. And President Trump, despite promising last year that he would never sign another bill that blew up the deficit the way last year's budget deal did, is now indicating that he does plan to sign this year's deal, which is actually worse for the long-term debt and deficit. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that current policies, which don't include the spending hike that was approved by Congress just this week, are already on pace to add another $11 trillion to the debt by the end of 2029. And if Trump does sign the budget deal that passed Congress this week, then the 45th president will have personally added $4.1 trillion to the national debt in just a little over 2 years since taking office, according to a new analysis from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which is a nonprofit that advocates for balanced budgets and low deficits. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky said Wednesday on the Senate floor that he saw the budget deal as the last nail in the coffin of the Tea Party. The Tea Party, of course, the grassroots conservative movement that sprung up a decade ago to oppose higher spending and bigger deficits during the Obama administration. And if Republicans were unable to muster enough opposition to stop this deficit-increasing budget deal, then you know Democrats were going to be functionally useless to do anything. Even with the $2.7 trillion deal hanging in the balance, Democratic candidates for president did not utter a single word about the national debt or the federal deficit during their debates in Detroit this week. There was some robust discussion about healthcare spending during the debates, and it's true that healthcare spending does account for about 40% of all federal outlays, but all that talk was only in the context of debating how much more of Americans' healthcare costs the government should cover. Questions focusing on how Democrats would pay for Medicare for All and other public healthcare proposals were mostly brushed off by candidates as Republican talking points. And that's somewhat ironic because the barb really gives Republicans far more credit than they deserve, given their recent track record on blowing up the deficit and wrecking the budget. Maybe CNN should take some of the blame for that, though. I mean, its debate moderators spent more than 4 hours over the past two nights grilling 20 presidential hopefuls, and yet they didn't see fit to ask a single question about the $22 trillion national debt or about the new budget deal that was about to be voted on in the Senate. And considering that several of the candidates on the stage are current members of the U.S. Senate or members of the U.S. House, CNN really missed an important and obvious opportunity to give voters a chance to draw distinctions between and among the 20 members of the debate field. Would any of the Democratic candidates have offered even the slightest suggestion that adding trillions more to the $22 trillion national debt might be a mistake that we'll regret later? Well, maybe we'll find out at the next debate in September, but don't hold your breath. Between the debate that took place in Detroit this week and the actions that took place in Congress, I think it's pretty obvious that neither major party has much of a concern or a plan for how to deal with the national debt and the ongoing and growing federal budget deficit. That's a problem that's going to have to be solved, and probably sooner rather than later. But right now, honestly, there's just no political will to do it, and that is maybe the most serious problem facing our country as we roll into the 2020 presidential election. Will anyone care? I guess we'll have to wait and find out. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can read more about the Democratic primary debates and about this disaster of a budget deal at Reason.com. Head on over there to check out all of that, and you'll catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Joe Biden has flip-flopped on federal funding for abortion. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says such a move would result in more minority babies being aborted.
Imagine if Donald Trump announced he would change his longtime opposition to public funding of abortion in order to ensure that Black, Hispanic, and poor women can abort their babies. Would liberals need even 10 seconds before foaming at the mouth, screaming, "Racist!" Well, alas, in a big announcement while campaigning in Atlanta, Joe Biden, Democrat presidential frontrunner for 2020, said, quote, For many years as a U.S. senator, I've supported the Hyde Amendment, as many, many others have, because there were sufficient monies and circumstances where women were able to exercise that right to abortion. Women of color, poor women, women were not able to have access, but circumstances have changed. Thus, said Biden, quote, "I can't justify leaving millions of women without access to the care they need," unquote. In response, the crowd of liberal women went wild, stomping, clapping, cheering. It was an incredible moment, a sick moment. Think about what Joe Biden said to liberals' roaring approval. He's reversing his long-held position so women of color, poor women, can get abortions. That is, have them publicly paid for. He's changing specifically because of women of color and poor women. He wants them to be able to have their abortions. He wants to make sure the money isn't an issue. He wants no obstacles to them securing their desire to abort their child. This change is prompted wholly on their behalf. Women of color, poor women. Well, the fact is that abortion victimizes already minorities by leaps and bounds. National figures show that abortions by Black and Hispanic women outpace white women by 4.5 times. Some civil rights leaders, including Dr. Alveda King, have called this Black genocide. Well, America's minorities should know how much Joe Biden has their back. He wants to make sure they get free abortions. And he's hardly alone in his switch. The Democratic Party once supported the Hyde Amendment, but progressives have since progressed. They're now more enlightened. The Hyde Amendment, must be aborted, so Americans can support abortions for poor women, women of color, Black women, Hispanic women. Patty Solis Doyle, who served as Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign manager in 2008 and who's worked for Biden, says this, quote, "The problem is the Hyde Amendment affects poor women, women of color, Black women, Hispanic women." And whose lives are eliminated in this equation, Ms. Doyle? The answer, poor babies, babies of color, babies of Black women, babies of Hispanic women. Planned Parenthood, naturally, is thrilled with Biden hopping on the progressive bandwagon. Minority women are its biggest customers. Lena Wen of Planned Parenthood states, quote, "Happy to see Joe Biden embrace what we have long known to be true. Hyde blocks people, particularly women of color, and women with low incomes from accessing safe, legal abortion care," unquote. You can't make this up. And it's no laughing matter. Just ask Elizabeth Warren. Choking back tears filled with anger, she insisted to an audience of clapping, stomping, emotional women that Hyde must be reversed. "Understand this," said Warren, voice trembling. "Women of means will still have access to abortions. Who won't will be poor women." This is the prevailing position of today's Democratic presidential candidates and the party generally. Liberals tell us they love Blacks and the poor. They're just oozing with compassion for them, so much so that they will strive to ensure that you, as a taxpayer, are forced by the state to help ensure that every Black or poor woman who wants to terminate her child will not be financially prohibited. Wow, what compassion. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WYYC-AM in York, Pennsylvania, WIJD-AM in Mobile, Alabama, along with WNVY-AM and WVTJ-AM in Pensacola, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.